From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, our tribute to Frank Sinatra continues. We'll find out what it was like to grow up as his daughter from Nancy Sinatra. We'll ask one of Sinatra's biggest fans to choose a favorite record, and we'll hear journalist Gay Talese read an excerpt of his 1966 Esquire article, Sinatra Has a Cold, which offers a glimpse of Sinatra's life during his heyday. And book critic Maureen Corrigan selects the best of the books she read this year, fiction and nonfiction. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing out the year with a series of programs paying tribute to Frank Sinatra. He turned 82 this month, as several new books were published about his life, his music, and his sense of style. A couple of years ago, when Sinatra turned 80, his daughter Nancy put together a book commemorating the occasion called Frank Sinatra, An American Legend. We spoke then about her father. I asked her to choose a song her father recorded that has personal significance for her. And she chose this 1944 recording of She's Funny That Way. He used to sing the song for her mother, his first wife. Nancy says many years later, her father said he still thought of her mother when he sang it.
I'm not much to look at, nothing to see, just glad I'm living and happy to be. I got a woman crazy for me. She's funny that way. I can't save a dollar, ain't worth a cent. She'd never holler, she'd live in a tent. I got a woman crazy for me. She's funny that way.
Nancy Sinatra's book came with a CD that included excerpts of Frank Sinatra's early radio broadcasts. I asked her to tell us about his very first radio appearance on the Major Bowes original Amateur Hour, on which Sinatra appeared in 1935 as part of a group named the Hoboken Four.
They were a separate group, the three guys, and I think they were called the Three Flashes. Major Bowes knew they were all from Hoboken, and I guess that was his little brainchild. Or maybe it was just to shorten the time of their performances. I'm not sure why he put them together, but he did, and he named them the Hoboken Four. My dad traveled with them for a while and then began to resent the fact that he ended up as part of this quartet because he had auditioned as a solo artist.
So Major Bowes stuck Sinatra with this trio to form the Hoboken.
Exactly.
Okay, so this is Frank Sinatra's very first radio appearance, 1935, with the Hoboken Four.
Shine and sway your bluesy. Why don't you shine? Start with your shoesy. Shine each place up. Make it look like new.
Boom, 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 boom.
Shine your face up. Mm-hmm. I want to see you wear a smile at you. Oh, shine. You're these and those. You'll find everything turn out right fine. Folks will shine up to you. Everybody's going to hide you, do you? You'll make the whole world chocolate drops. Let me hear you. Shine up to you. Everybody's gonna hide you, dear. You'll make the whole world shine.
Shine and sway your bluesy.
Ah. shine, start with your shoes. Ah, you'll make the whole world shine.
That's Frank Sinatra's first radio appearance. And my guest is Nancy Sinatra, who's written a new book about her father called Frank Sinatra, An American Legend. Did your father talk with you much about those early days when he was trying to find himself professionally?
He talked a lot about his family in those days, how disappointed they were that he didn't stay in school. He told me a lot about his early jobs, washing dishes, just anything to scrounge up a few pennies. Now, he hates pennies so much, he doesn't even look at them. He ignores them. He puts them away in a jar, gets rid of them immediately.
I want to play another recording from the CD that comes with your new book, Frank Sinatra, An American Legend. And this is the recording of his last broadcast with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra when he's introducing his replacement, Dick Hames. This was recorded in 1942. Let's listen to it.
Folks, this is Frank Sinatra's farewell broadcast with his band. After tonight, he's going to be strictly on his own. And, Frank, I want to tell you that everyone in the band wishes you the best of luck.
Thanks, Mac, and I'd like to say that I'm going to miss all you guys after kicking around for 3 years. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like you to meet the boy who's going to take my place as the vocalist with Tommy in the band. He's a fine guy, a wonderful singer, and he was good enough for Harry James and Benny Goodman, and that's really saying plenty. Folks, I'd like you to meet Dick Hames.
Well, Frank, I don't know if anyone can really take your place with this band, but I'm going to be in there trying. You can bet on that. As for you, well, I know that you'll be knocking them dead on your own hook.
So, thanks,
well,
Dick.
I agree with you there, Dick, and thanks a lot, Dick Hames. Frank, before you hit the road, how about one more song just for Auld Lang Syne?
That's all right with me, Tom. Give me the beat on our arrangement of the song as you, and I'll see what I can do with it.
I hear music when I look at you, a beautiful theme of every dream I ever knew.
Back with Nancy Sinatra, the recording we just heard is featured on a CD that comes with her new book about her father. Did he talk to you much about this period of his life, leaving Tommy Dorsey, or what it was like to be with the big bands?
Yes, we really went into that in depth because a lot of the legend, the negative legend or myth about him has to do with his leaving Dorsey and how he managed to get out of that horrible contract.
What was so bad about the contract?
It was over a third of his income that was sort of held hostage by Tommy Dorsey for the rest of Frank's life, which I thought was just horrendous. And it was handled by, the breaking of the contract was handled by the top agents and lawyers in the business in New York. And but the myth was that that mafia people, I don't even know who they were supposedly, but the myth was that these people went to Tommy Dorsey and made him an offer he couldn't refuse. Mario Puzo told me that he made up that line in The Godfather, that he'd never heard that about my dad or connected with my dad. But now, of course, everybody thinks it's his. The Dorsey contract, according to my dad, was almost impossible to break. So he really had to get some very strong attorneys in there. And what they did was they reminded Tommy Dorsey that he liked broadcasting on NBC, and these people represented NBC. And they said, if you want to continue to work for NBC, you're going to have to let this guy go.
So what was the next step for your father after he left the Dorsey Orchestra?
Well, one of the legendary moments of his life. He went to the Paramount Theater alone, but working for, alone meaning not connected to an orchestra, but working for or with Benny Goodman and his orchestra. and it was total tumult. I mean, the theater just, the way it was described to me was it felt like the theater was just going to come down.
When you were 4 years old, your father, I think he recorded Nancy with a Laughing Face.
Mm-hmm.
And that song, was it what, a present for you for your fourth birthday? Is that?
Oh, I don't know if it was a present. An interesting, sweet sidelight of that is that Jimmy Van Heusen, when I turned 16, he wrote the music for the song. He gave me his rights, his ASCAP rights,
really?
To the song when I turned 16. Isn't that dear?
That really is.
Isn't that adorable? I don't know if it was a gift for me when I was a little girl, but it certainly is a gift for me now. I love hearing it. Whenever I hear it, it brings a lump to my throat, you know. It's very sentimental.
Was it supposed to be about you? I mean, it sounds really like it's a song to a lover than a daughter, but...
No, it was about me, yeah. Lyrics written by Phil Silvers, the wonderful comedic actor, who also, by the way, named his daughter Nancy after the song.
Why don't we hear it?
Okay.
If I don't see her each day, I miss her. Gee, what a thrill each time I kiss her. I've got a terrible case on Nancy with a laughing face. She takes the winter and makes it summer. But summer could take some lessons from her. Picture a tomboy in lace. That's Nancy with a laughing face.
How much did you see your father when you were growing up? How much was he actually home?
Not a whole lot. He was really, I liken his work to traveling salesman. You know, he was pretty much a traveling salesman. I heard him on the radio a lot as a little girl. The most normal part of my childhood was when he was under contract to MGM. And we were living in the San Fernando Valley in California. And we actually got to have dinner together and breakfast together. And that was kind of Father Knows Best time for us.
When your father started having affairs with other women and that was being covered by the press, and your mother was finding out sometimes through press reports about it, what was it like for you in the house?
My mother had a knack, and still has really, of putting forward a happy face. She generally kept that stuff from us. She, after they actually split, when my dad was looking to marry Ava Gardner, I think the reality of it set in, and she could not help but be sad. I mean, it was just too tough for her. So for that period of time, we were sad also, because not because we understood divorce or anything. I mean, Dad, we were used to his being away. Tina never knew him any other way. But because of my mother's sadness, it was not self-indulgent in any way. It was just she couldn't avoid it. I mean, she would have heart palpitations and faint a little, or have what I guess used to be called the vapors. You know, she just couldn't get it together for a while. But life went on. I mean, we still, you know, we still kept our commitments to Brownie Troops or Bluebirds or whatever we were doing at the time, and my brother with his Cub Scouts and all of that stuff, you know. Nothing really changed.
When your parents divorced, was your father still a part of your life, even though he was still on the road a lot and you maybe didn't get to see him very much?
Always. Yeah, always. Again, it didn't change much. It was really like he was still on the road, in a way.
Nancy Sinatra recorded in 1995. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. When I spoke with Nancy Sinatra, we not only talked about her father's career, we talked a bit about her own. She's best known for her hit, These Boots Are Made for Walking, and for her duet with her father, Something Stupid. But her earlier records were bubblegum productions overseen by Annette Funicello's music director. They did okay overseas, but bombed in the States. In fact, her label, Reprise, was getting ready to dump her, even though the label was founded by her father. Reprise was willing to give her one more chance in 1965, and with some help, she changed her image and her luck.
Jimmy Bowen, who was head of A&R at Reprise, put me with a guy named Lee Hazelwood. Lee had approached Jimmy, unbeknownst to me. He said, I can get her a chart record in this country, and if I don't get her a chart record in this country, you can tell me to leave. And he said, I promise a chart record the first time out. And he delivered. It was called So Long, Babe. And it barely made the charts, but it made the charts. During that session, he said to me, you can't sing like Nancy Nicelady anymore. You have to sing for the truckers. At about this time, I was getting a divorce. My husband decided he didn't want to have children, and I did, and he knew it. So we split. And Lee said to me, you've been married, and now you're divorced, and people know that. So let's lose this virgin image. Let's get rid of it. And we did that, and we lowered the key. We dropped my voice down where it belonged, again, where I was more comfortable early on in the more R&B type things.
Let's hear These Boots Are Made for Walking from a recent collection of your greatest hits on Rhino Records.
Okay.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
Nancy Sinatra is my guest. Did your whole image change after this record came out? The way you dressed, what your whole public persona?
You know, again, timing is everything in life. I had been on tour in Europe. I brought home from Carnaby Street the miniskirt. And I wasn't crazy about the way my legs looked in the miniskirt, so I put on a pair of boots. I wore that around. It became my favorite thing to wear. I wore it to the dance clubs that I went to.
I must stop you right here. Were they white boots?
No, they weren't. Actually, they were kind of a camely brown color.
Uh-huh.
And you know, people would make fun of me saying, well, what are you going to play, tennis or what? You know, because the miniskirt was not a staple the way it is now. As a matter of fact, it wasn't seen at all, you know?
Now, a little later on, you recorded a duet with your father, Something Stupid. one thing that's always interested me about this record is that it's a song sung from the perspective of two lovers, but you were singing it as father and daughter. Was that a slightly awkward thing to do?
No, it was a very natural thing to do, but the disc jockeys dubbed it the incest song.
Oh, really?
At the time, which I think probably added to it in a way. You know, it gave them something fun to kid about. Now recording it, there are different ways to love people, I think, you know.
Was it daunting to record a duet with your father, or were you relaxed about it?
I was very relaxed about it. I had had a certain number of hits of my own, and the scary part, though, was coming in when at the end of the session that they were doing that night with Jobim.
Oh, that's the date he recorded with Antonio Carlos Jobim.
Mm-hmm. Oh. It was one of the sessions for that album, the first of their albums.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, coming in with my little, I called us the B team. Coming in with the B team and watching the A team in action, I was just, it was enthralling. And I don't like this word, but awesome. You know, and then of course the A team moved over, and the little B team took over: Lee Hazelwood, Jimmy Bowen, Billy Strange, and our rhythm section, and we cut a number one song.
Yeah, you delivered.
Yeah.
Why don't we hear it? This is my guest Nancy Sinatra and her father Frank Sinatra.
I know I stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. Then afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you. I can see it in your eyes that you despise the same old lies you heard the night before. And though it's just a line to you, for me it's true and never seemed so right before. I practice every day to find some clever lines to say to make the meaning come through. Then I think I'll wait until the evening gets late and I'm alone with you. The time is right, your perfume fills my head, the stars get red and oh, the night's so blue. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you.
Our interview with Nancy Sinatra was recorded in 1995. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, our Sinatra tribute continues with one of the biggest Sinatra fans and collectors. We'll also hear journalist Gay Talese read an excerpt of his 1966 piece, Sinatra Has a Cold. And our book critic, Marin Corrigan, chooses the best of the books she read in 97. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today and tomorrow, we're paying tribute to Frank Sinatra, who turned 82 this month. For a lot of people, Sinatra's records of the 40s, 50s, and 60s are bound up in memories of the past. But those recordings are also loved by people too young to have those associations. Foremost among his younger admirers is Charles Granata. Granata is a 34-year-old cop who has amassed so many Sinatra records, photos, and related material that he now has a Sinatra archive. Several Sinatra reissues have used graphics from the collection. He was the project manager of a box set of Sinatra V-discs and project director of the box set Frank Sinatra, The Columbia Years, 1943-52. I asked Charles Granata to choose one of his favorite recordings from The Columbia Years.
I think the one song that really typifies Sinatra at Columbia as a ballad artist, because primarily during the Columbia years, he was known as a ballad artist, and that's really the style that he perfected.
And we're talking about, what, the late 40s and early 50s?
Yeah, Sinatra was at Columbia from 1943 until 1952, and during that period, he developed his true song styling. I mean, Sinatra became a song stylist. He wasn't just another singer, and people really recognized Sinatra as a ballad singer. And I think the one ballad that I love that really typifies Sinatra as a ballad artist at Columbia is his version of Body and Soul.
Oh, that's a beautiful record.
It's gorgeous. It's got a great Bobby Hackett cornet solo. Sinatra's emotion is just right. I mean, everything about this recording is, for me, it's just perfection, and it really is the quintessential Sinatra Columbia song or ballad.
It's a great record. Let's hear it.
My heart is sad and lonely. For you I sigh, for you, dear, only. Why haven't you seen it? I'm all for you, body and soul. I spend my days in longing and wondering why it's me you're wronging. I tell you, I mean it. I'm all for you, body and soul.
Have you ever met Sinatra?
I met Frank at the Waldorf Astoria in 1985.
How did you get to meet him?
I just walked up to him. I knew we had seen his concerts at Carnegie Hall twice that week, and I knew that he went back to the Waldorf after he was done with the show. And my wife and I waited at the Waldorf in the alleyway where the cars come in, and he pulled up in his limo, and he got out, and we were the only people there. And he was very gracious. He signed an album cover for me, and he talked to me for a minute. He was just very, very gracious.
What'd you say to him? Did you tell him, oh, I have a whole archive about you?
No, but at that point, you have to remember, I was only about probably 22 years old, and I was just awed that I was, meeting Frank Sinatra. To me, that was just totally incredible. And I remember saying to him that I really appreciated his music and that I really loved the concerts that week. And the thing that struck me was that, you know, he very easily could have just signed this album that I gave him and just tossed it back at me. You know, he really took a lot of time. He looked it over and he kind of chuckled to himself, you know, as though he were remembering something about the album. And then he signed it, you know, and it's the Wee Small Hours album. And he's standing on a lonely street with a lamppost, and he's got a cigarette in his hand. And I remember that he very carefully signed the F to the left of the cigarette, so he didn't go over the smoke, and then he looked at it, and then he continued to sign on the other side. He was just so nice about it. And then, you know, I'd heard horror stories, you know, that you couldn't get near him, and that if you approached him, that these bodyguards would pounce on you and kill you, and it wasn't like that at all. He was just very gracious. It was a great experience.
Well, Chuck Granata, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It was great.
Charles Granata recorded in 1995. The album that Sinatra autographed for him in the Wee Small Hours is also Nancy Sinatra's favorite. Let's hear a song from it.
What is this thing
called love. This funny thing called love. Just who can solve its mystery? And why should it make a fool of me?
Coming up, Sinatra has a cold. This is Fresh Air. Frank Sinatra not only defined a style of singing, he defined a lifestyle that was flashy, sometimes crude, and shared by a small group of buddies who were fellow celebrities like Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr., the Rat Pack. One of the most famous accounts of Sinatra's life during his heyday was written by journalist Gay Talese and first published in Esquire magazine in 1966. It was called Sinatra Has a Cold. Talese read an excerpt of it for the public radio program This American Life. We're going to play that reading for you now.
Frank Sinatra, holding a glass of bourbon in one hand and a cigarette in the other, stood in a dark corner of a bar between two attractive but fading blondes who sat waiting for him to say something. But he said nothing. He had been silent during much of the evening, except now in this private club in Beverly Hills he seemed even more distant, staring out through the smoke and the semi-darkness into a large room beyond the bar where dozens of young couples sat huddled around small tables or twisted in the center of the floor to the clamorous clang of folk rock music blaring from the stereo. The two blondes knew, as did Sinatra's four male friends who stood nearby, that it was a bad idea to force conversation upon him when he was in this mood of sullen silence, a mood that had hardly been uncommon during this first week of November, a month before his 50th birthday. Sinatra had been working in a film that he now disliked and could not wait to finish. He was tired of all the publicity attached to his dating the 20-year-old Mia Farrow, who was not in sight tonight. He was angry that a CBS television documentary of his life, to be shown in 2 weeks, was reportedly prying into his privacy, even speculating on his possible friendships with mafia leaders. He was worried about his starring role in an hour-long NBC show entitled Sinatra, A Man and His Music, which would require that he sing 18 songs with a voice that at this particular moment, just a few nights before the taping was to begin, was weak and sore and uncertain. Sinatra was ill. He was a victim of an ailment so common that most people would consider it trivial. But when it gets to Sinatra, it can plunge him into a state of anguish and deep depression, panic, even rage. Frank Sinatra had a cold. Sinatra with a cold is Picasso without paint, Ferrari without fuel, only worse. For the common cold robs Sinatra of that uninsurable jewel, his voice, cutting into the core of his confidence, and it affects not only his own psyche, but also seems to cause a kind of psychosomatic nasal drip within dozens of people who work for him, drink with him, depend on him for their own welfare and stability. A Sinatra with a cold can, in a small way, send vibrations through the entertainment industry and beyond, as surely as a president of the United States suddenly sick can shake the national economy. For Frank Sinatra was now involved with many things involving many people. His own film company, his record company, his private airline, his missile parts firm, his real estate holdings across the nation, his personal staff of 75, which are only a portion of the power he is and has come to represent. He now seemed to be also the embodiment of the fully emancipated male, perhaps the only one in America, the man who can do anything he wants, anything, can do it because he has the money, the energy, and no apparent guilt. All the way. All or nothing at all. This is the Sicilian in Sinatra. He permits his friends, if they wish to remain that, none of the easy Anglo-Saxon outs. But if they remain loyal, then there is nothing Sinatra will not do for them. Fabulous gifts, personal kindnesses, encouragement when they're down, adulation when they're up. They are wise to remember, however, one thing. He is Sinatra, the boss, il padrone. Or better still, he is what in traditional Sicily have long been called uomini rispettati, men of respect, men who are both majestic and humble, men who are loved by all and are very generous by nature, men whose hands are kissed as they walk from village to village, men who would personally go out of their way to redress a wrong. Frank Sinatra does things personally. At Christmas time, he will personally pick dozens of presents for his close friends and family, remembering the type of jewelry they like, their favorite colors, the size of their shirts and dresses. The same Sinatra can, within the same hour, explode in a towering rage of intolerance at a small thing being correctly done for him by one of his paisanos. For example, when one of his men brought him a frankfurter with ketchup on it, which Sinatra apparently abhors, he angrily threw the bottle at the man, splattering ketchup all over him. In Las Vegas, after the last show at the Sands, the Sinatra crowd, which numbered about 20, all got into a line of cars and headed for another club. It was 3 o'clock. The night was young. They stopped at the Sahara, taking a long table near the back, and listened to a bald-headed little comedian named Don Rickles, who was probably more caustic than any other comic in the country. His humor is so rude and such bad taste that it offends no one because it's too offensive to be offensive. Spotting Eddie Fisher among the audience, Rickles proceeded to ridicule him as a lover, saying it was no wonder that he could not handle Elizabeth Taylor. And when two businessmen in the audience acknowledged that they were Egyptians, Rickles cut into them and their country's policy toward Israel. And he strongly suggested that the woman seated at one table with her husband was actually a hooker. When the Sinatra crowd walked in, Don Rickles could not be more delighted. Pointing to Sinatra's pal, Jilly Rizzo, Rickles yelled, "How's it feel to be Frank's tractor?" Yeah, Jilly keeps walking in front of Frank, clearing the way. Then, nodding to Leo DeRocher, a former baseball player, Rickles said, "Stand up, Leo. Show Frank how you slide." Then he focused on Sinatra, not failing to mention Mia Farrow, nor that he was wearing a toupee, nor to say that Sinatra was washed up as a singer. And when Sinatra laughed, everybody laughed. And Rickles pointed toward Joey Bishop and said, "Bishop keeps checking with Frank to see what's funny." Then after Rickles told some Jewish jokes, Dean Martin stood up and yelled, "Hey, you're always talking about the Jews, never about the Italians." And Rickles cut him off. "What do we need the Italians for? All they do is keep the flies off our fish." Sinatra laughed. They all laughed. And Rickles went on this way for nearly an hour until Sinatra, standing up, said, All right. Come on, get this thing over with. I gotta go." "Shut up and sit down," Rickles yelled. "I've had to listen to you sing." "Who do you think you're talking to?" Sinatra yelled. "Dick Hames," Rickles replied, and Sinatra laughed again. And then Dean Martin, pouring a bottle of whiskey over his head, entirely drenching his tuxedo, pounded the table. By 4 a.m., Frank Sinatra led the group out of the Sahara, some of them carrying their glasses of whiskey with them, sipping it along the sidewalk and into the cars, and then returning to the Sands, they walked into the gaming casino. It was still packed with people. The roulette wheels were spinning, the crapshooters were screaming in the far corner. Frank Sinatra, holding a shot glass of bourbon in his left hand, walked through the crowd. He, unlike some of his friends, was perfectly pressed, his tuxedo tie precisely pointed, his shoes unsmudged. He never seems to lose his dignity, never lets his guard completely down, no matter how much he is drunk, nor how long he's been up. He never sways when he walks like Dean Martin, nor does he dance in the aisles or jump up on the tables like Sammy Davis. A part of Sinatra, no matter where he is never there. There's always a part of him, though sometimes a small part, that remains il padrone. The crowd that had gathered around him now opened to let him through. but a woman stopped in front of him, handing him a piece of paper. He signed it, and then he said, "Thank you." In the rear of the Sands' large dining room was a long table reserved for Sinatra. The dining room was fairly empty at this hour, with perhaps 24 other people in the room, including a table of 4 unescorted young ladies sitting near Sinatra. On the other side of the room, at a long table, sat 7 men shoulder to shoulder against the wall, 2 of them wearing dark glasses, all of them eating quietly, speaking hardly a word, just sitting and eating and missing nothing. The Sinatra party, after getting settled and having a few more drinks, ordered something to eat. The table was about the same size as the one reserved for Sinatra whenever he's at Gilly's in New York, and the people seated around this table in Las Vegas were mainly the same people who are often seen with Sinatra at Gilly's restaurant in New York, or at a restaurant in California, or in Italy, or in New Jersey, wherever Sinatra happens to be. When Sinatra sits to dine, his trusted friends are close. And no matter where he is, no matter how elegant the place may be, there's something of the neighborhood showing because Sinatra, no matter how far he has come, is still something of the boy from the neighborhood. Only now, he can take his neighborhood with him. In some ways, the quasi-family affair at the reserved table in a public place is the closest thing Sinatra now has to home life.
Gaita Lee is reading an excerpt of his 1966 article, Sinatra Has a Cold, which was first published in Esquire magazine. His reading was recorded for This American Life, which is produced at WBEZ in Chicago and distributed by Public Radio International. Our thanks to Ira Glass and Peter Clowney. Well, let's hear Sinatra doing one of his signature songs. This is a 1958 rehearsal session with Sinatra and pianist Bill Miller.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story you ought to know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road. I got the routine. Put another nickel in the machine. Feeling so bad. Can't you make the music easy and sad? I could tell you a lot, but you gotta be true to your code. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road. You'd never know it, but buddy, I'm a kind of poet, and I got a lot of things I'd like to say. And when I'm gloomy, won't you listen to me till it's talked away? Well, that's how it goes. And Joe, I know you're getting anxious to close. And thanks for the cheer. I hope you didn't mind my bend in your ear. But this torch that I found's gotta be drowned, or it soon might explode. So make it one for my baby and one more for the road, the long, that long, it's long.
Our Frank Sinatra tribute concludes tomorrow. Coming up, our book critic chooses her favorite books of the year. This is Fresh Air. If you like to get lost for a week at a time in a big, bulky book, critic Maureen Carrigan says 1997 was your year.
This year, even more than other years, I feel obliged to preface my best books of 1997 list with the warning, these are the best books of 1997 that I've read. 1997 generated so many thick books that in trying to keep pace with them, I increasingly felt like my heroine, Lucille Ball, playing the frantic assembly line worker in that immortal candy factory episode of I Love Lucy. So, to repeat, these are the best books of 1997 that I've read. And that noted, I will tell you that I've read some darn good books this year. In fiction, this was the year of the strong, old-fashioned narrative, as exemplified by Charles Frazier's surprise bestseller, Cold Mountain. The novel's chapters alternate between the Ulysses-like struggles of a Confederate soldier to return home and the trials of the woman he left behind. This really is one of those wonderful books whose world and characters feel more real than the everyday life passing around you. Another very good, traditionally plotted novel was Jeanette Haynes' Matters of Chance, which recounts 40 years in the life of an affluent Ohio family. Amidst personal trials and the tumult of the Depression and World War II, Haynes' likable characters cling to rules of etiquette as drowning people cling to driftwood. The characters in Haldor Laxness's reprinted 1946 novel, Independent People, subsist on the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum. Independent People, which helped earn Laxness the Nobel Prize for Literature, chronicles the long life of an Icelandic sheep farmer and dramatizes what Marx called the idiocy of rural life. And then there were two weird works of fiction that I loved. James Hines's wicked short story collection, Publish and Perish, which combines academic satire with the trappings of the traditional horror story, and Kirsten Backus's Lives of the Monster Dogs, which is my pick for the most original and maybe even the most affecting novel of 1997. Like the best fantasy fiction, Backus's story about a race of monster dogs that appears in Manhattan stirs up restive yearnings for improbable worlds and a sobering sense of the limits of this one. As far as nonfiction goes, the first place choice is clear. J. Anthony Lucas's Big Trouble, and I'd make the same call even if Lucas were still alive. Lucas's sweeping account of the class warfare that almost tore turn-of-the-century America apart needs nobody's pity to distinguish it as a great book. A much more circumscribed but also important work of investigative journalism was Melanie Thernstrom's Halfway Heaven, which explored the murder-suicide of two Harvard undergraduates. The Gay Metropolis, Charles Kaiser's history of gay life in Manhattan from World War II to the present, is a first-rate work of social history. And the monumental first volume of R.F. Foster's projected two-volume biography, W.B. Yeats, told me almost more than I wanted to know about Yeats's obsession with the occult. Finally, Vivian Gornick's The End of the Novel of Love was one of the most provocative and readable works of popular literary criticism published in this or any other year. Let's move into the very loose category of first-person writing. John Krakauer's Into Thin Air, about the ill-starred 1996 expedition to Mount Everest, was so suspenseful that while reading it, I felt as oxygen-deprived as Krakauer must have been when he reached Everest's summit. Jean-Dominique Bobie's memoir, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, recounts an endurance test of a different sort. Bobie, who died shortly after writing his book, was rendered almost completely paralyzed by something called locked-in syndrome. So he blinked out the words of his powerful story letter by letter using an alphabet code. I also really enjoyed Elizabeth Ehrlich's seductive memoir, Miriam's Kitchen, which weds a midlife search for meaning to a search for the best recipes for noodlekugel and honey cake. No good reading year would be complete without a little murder and mayhem. Deception on His Mind by Elizabeth George was an outstanding, gritty mystery about racial hatred in modern-day England. Small Vices by Robert B. Parker brought his detective hero Spencer back from the land of the literary undead. Lawrence Block's Even the Wicked was a superbly plotted Matthew Scudder story. And The Club Dumas by Spain's Arturo Perez Reverte was an eerie, erudite tale of antiquarian booksellers gone bad. In this last week of 1997, I'm halfway into P.D. James's newest mystery, A Certain Justice, and so far it's terrific. So the omens for 1998 look promising. In the new year, I wish you peace and plenty of time to finish all the good books waiting ahead for you.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from TVT Records, presenting the Rhythm Review 3-CD box set, featuring 53 R&B and soul classics from Public Radio's Rhythm Review show. This is NPR, National Public Radio.